Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show...
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls.
3 days ago, at 2 a.m. local time on Friday, an unconditional ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas came into effect, ending over 2 weeks of fighting. On the Palestinian side, some 250 people were killed, thousands injured, and according to the United Nations, over 70,000 people were left homeless. On the Israeli side, 12 people lost their lives and dozens were wounded. But the ultimate cost of this conflict to both sides might end up being much higher. Here with me to discuss the war, the ceasefire, and what the immediate future holds, I'm joined by Aluf Ben, Noah Landau, and Anshul Pfeffer. Welcome, guys. Good to have you here. Both sides are now claiming victory in what you, Aluf, called Israel's most failed and pointless Gaza operation ever. Hamas held victory parades and Prime Minister Netanyahu told a press conference that the operation changed the equation with Hamas. So did both sides win or did both sides lose?
I think that both sides lost. First of all, because of the loss of lives and damage to property and so on, and extreme expenditures on nothing, but it doesn't change basically anything in the tense relationship between Israel and Gaza. It's another round of violence, which is pointless. You know, Hamas is not weaker; it's not going anywhere.
Even after firing 4,000 rockets,
it's not stronger by doing that. Israel is not going anywhere either. In other words, the basic military equation remains the same. Air superiority held by Israel, which can attack Gaza, that doesn't have any air defenses. Very successful Israeli defensive shield around Gaza, both underground, in the sea, and in the air with Iron Dome, which intercepts most of the rockets coming into Israel. While at the same time, strong Hamas deterrence against any thought of ground operation, of an Israeli ground operation in Gaza, which entails large number of casualties and allegations of war crimes afterwards, etc.
Even senior IDF officials, according to our lead headline this morning, have raised doubts about the effectiveness of the operation. They're especially worried about Hamas's rocket infrastructure, saying that it wasn't destroyed enough, and Tzachi Hanegbi over the weekend said that Israel will preemptively attack Hamas's rocket capabilities in the future. Does that mean that there could be another flare-up any moment?
Well, first of all, another flare-up could be and most probably will be sometimes. Not in the near future, but in the medium future or whatever. But I think what underlies the criticism by these unnamed military officials is that the main operation carried out by the IDF, which was to attack the underground bunkers and tunnels of Hamas in Gaza from the air in an effort to lock as many Hamas fighters in there and kill them, was designed by ground officers in order to prevent, preempt, or punish any effort to attack Israel from the ground through tunnels, by attacking Israeli villages across the border and so on, which Hamas did attack military positions within Israel in the previous operation. It cannot and would not be an answer to the Hamas rocket capability, which remained intact, taking into account the rockets they fired and lost by using them. The basic elements of the rocket capability, the command and control system, the ability to cover large parts of Israeli territory with rockets remains the same, and have yet to hear any argument to the contrary by Israeli officials.
So what could change the equation then? International pressure, regime change in Israel or in Gaza?
Well, the silence says it all.
I think that some very strong TikTok videos by 17-year-olds in New York and L.A. will probably make a lot of change.
You know, I want to read you a quote from Haaretz's editorial. The Gaza Strip, with its millions of residents, needs not just reconstruction of its ruins, but economic development that will include sea access, an airport, and the investment of billions of dollars so that it can realize its potential for growth. Given that we wrote that in 2014, after the previous war, anyone hold out any hope that something's changed, something could change?
Look, there was an airport in Gaza, and Gaza was going to be a hub, and then everything that happened in the last 20-odd years happened. You know, very recently, as an aviation geek, I noticed that they sold off the last plane of the Palestinian airline. And it's sort of illusion in the desert that there is something possible in Gaza. It could happen, but there's literally no political framework for that happening, in the internal Palestinian and not in the region, because Egypt has no interest and they're the ones who are controlling it. Israel has no interest under Netanyahu, and Mahmoud Abbas, Palestinian president, has no interest. So basically Gaza under Hamas is what there is, and as long as it's Gaza under Hamas, that's probably not going to happen.
But it doesn't mean that you should not work and try to promote this. Look, the basic argument here is that when people have more to lose, they are less prone to fight. And we've seen that to some extent in the West Bank, even to the extent that the occupation is very cheap from an Israeli standpoint to sustain. Mm. But then again, the Palestinians in the West Bank have a much better economy than their brothers and sisters and cousins in Gaza. Can you copy that idea of economic peace into Gaza? It's a big question. We have a different both international and regional constellation today with Biden as president of the United States, with the Abraham Accords in the region. It's not the same dynamics.
The thing is, those theories about economics and peace, they're not always true. Look at the Arabs or Palestinians within Israel, who have, of course, much more to lose than those in the West Bank, if we do, you know, that comparison. And in the end, some people, when they are more educated and maybe they have more to lose and maybe they have more wealth and etc., there's still ideology behind all this.
I agree.
And sometimes people are willing to fight for that ideology,
but
even if they have money and they're more educated.
Yes, but fighting vis-a-vis Gaza is not, you know, angry people trying to throw away their shekels. When you fire thousands of rockets, you need military command and control and a very sophisticated military system that entails someone who pulls the trigger. And the idea is that that they would have more to hesitate when they also have to care about development.
Of course, but what I'm saying is that it's not only about the economy. This is about self-determination, which is ideology, which is about your own identity. And people are willing to go to extreme lengths and do extreme things when they are fighting for their own identity and their self-determination. So I think that the whole idea that we can just pour money on Gaza is part of the problem, because as Simon said, we wrote this article in 2014, the international community did pour money over Gaza, maybe not at the extent that we wanted to, but there is the deal between Israel and Hamas, trying, you know, to fix everything with the luggage, with dollars from Qatar, etc. And it doesn't do the trick, because in the end, and I think the earlier silence indicates, you know, the frustration that we all have, because we know the solution, and yet, you know, this keeps going on, which is a diplomatic solution, a political solution. In the end, there is the issue that of the two-state solution or a different solution, but the framework needs to be political or diplomatic. But what happened in recent years is that Israel tried to strengthen Hamas with the use of that perspective that, you know, money will solve this, and it didn't.
But that was from a different motive. The reason for Netanyahu government's efforts to strengthen Hamas, to allow Hamas to prosper, were to prevent what Netanyahu was very effective in preventing any reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah, between Gaza and the West Bank, because he saw it as the best barrier against Palestinian state, which he opposes, and his party opposes, and his political camp opposes. So as long as you keep Gaza and the West Bank separate, so be it. And one way of doing that is to keep Hamas as kind of semi-partner or outsource contractor of Israel. At the same time, most of the time, Hamas prevents other players in Gaza from firing rockets. The question in my opinion, was whether Hamas used all kinds of tricks, like sending people to practically commit suicide on the border 3 years ago, and then using fire balloons against Israeli fields. Was that not kind of trick to prevent Israelis from looking at the real threat, which was the longer and bigger and stronger rockets that they built while using these fire balloons?
That's tactics. But I think on the strategic aspect, even if the international community will give each person in Gaza an imaginary sum of money, in the end, they want their own state, not
but
money.
Every one of these four arenas, and we're talking here about four arenas, we're talking about Gaza and the West Bank, we're also talking about Arab Israelis within the Green Land, and we're talking about East Jerusalem. We have four different Palestinian sub-communities under different jurisdictions. Every single one of them, one has Hamas, one has the PA, one has Israel as Israeli citizens, the other one has Israel as residents without citizenship, and every single dynamic there is different, and money comes into it, and politics comes into it. And what happened over the last 2 weeks is, for the first time since September, October 2000, three out of those four communities rose up or were in the conflict. The West Bank wasn't in the only difference between the second intifada is then, for a short while, all four of those sub-communities were in play or were rising up and were clashing very actively against Israel. And I think that Aleph is right. There is an issue of what you have to lose, because this is the first time in nearly 21 years that Arab Israelis in a large number rose up and clashed. And the people who were in, call them riots, call them clashes, whatever you want to call them, this time, most of them weren't even born last time around. They certainly weren't involved in the last time. So what happened to all the people who were there in October 2000? In the last 21 years, they've been trying to reach some kind of modus vivendi with Israel. Some call it Israelization, others call it Sumut, whatever you're going to call it, that's what's happening there. And suddenly, after 21 years, a significant group said, you know what, we want to break everything. We want to show that this is not for us. We're fed up with being second-class citizens. Maybe it's partly because of Al-Aqsa, partly with something to do with Gaza, but it's its own dynamic. And what's working very well for Netanyahu is that Netanyahu has really succeeded in dividing these dynamics as much as possible. We've seen here almost a freak occurrence in which three of them erupt at the same time, but the last time that happened was 21 years ago. And when will it happen again? Who knows? But we have to be looking here at all those four dynamics. And there's not just one political solution for them, certainly not one economic or strategic tactical solution. Some of them, the IDF are involved. Some of them, the police are involved. Police, as we saw, mismanaging East Jerusalem so badly 5 or 6 weeks ago. And then there's the biggest question is, how much is Israel really thinking about all these arenas in one go? Maybe Netanyahu had some kind of devious plan to try and provoke the... I don't think so. I think Aleph perhaps is more suspicious of Netanyahu's motives.
No, I didn't think so either.
Maybe it
doesn't. It doesn't mean that Netanyahu, at least to some extent, had some political benefits out of that.
Oh,
but I don't think he initiated the war in order to tear Bennett apart from the change.
We don't really know what
change.
War he's
but there really is not
we
one.
We just know the outcome.
These four arenas who are on different jurisdictions. There isn't one Israeli group. There should be, the National Security Council should be looking at all four of them together, but there isn't. You know, you have different commands in the army in charge, police, Shin Bet. There is no.
By the way, there's a fifth Palestinian group, the Palestinian groups in Lebanon, also fired rockets
and
Israel
and pro-Palestinians on the streets in Western cities. But it's enough just to try and look at these four arenas. There is no one group, no one council besides notionally the National Security Council, which is sort of supposed to be working with the Prime Minister, who's looking at all of them. There isn't an Israeli strategy here, unless you talk about 100 years of Zionism as being a strategy. There is no one Israeli way of except the Netanyahu idea of divide,
but
rule, and play for time.
Is it that complicated and separated, Anshul? Because I look at what our colleague Jackie Khoury wrote in recent days, and there is one, you know, specific issue that connects all these communities, and that is the Palestinian identity.
I agree.
It's
but they haven't.
Complicated
but
that
for
you
21
know, and
years.
All,
but for
and
21
by the way,
years,
the West Bank and the West Bank, there were also demonstrations. We need to separate, you know,
sure,
violence from you know, protests. But I think that all these communities were protesting, you know, violent or not, for the same cause.
I agree, but it's the first time it happened in 21 years.
And what were the Jewish?
When we had the other stages of the Second Intifada, the Arab Israelis were no longer part of it. When we had all these clashes in Gaza, 2009, 2012, 2014, Jerusalem wasn't part of it, West Bank wasn't part of it, Arab Israelis weren't part of it. So suddenly, we have the first time in over two decades when we have these arenas. So I agree, the West Bank also got worse and it kept out, but it wasn't totally calm. Also, what happened here is that unlike back in 2000, this was very short.
And that's
we're talking already a week after the worst things that happened in Lod and Ramle, and 3 days after the ceasefire with Gaza. So, you know, the question
is, we don't know that it's over yet.
Yeah, but the time span is different. We're in a new situation. This is the first time in our generation. Aleph and I were already working here, I think, in the Second Intifada. But it still is a new thing. Like, for more than 20 years, and many of the people, the soldiers, the police officers, certainly the Palestinian protesters, weren't born the last time this happened. So this is something new. But on the other hand, it's not yet an Intifada because, as you said, we don't know how long this is lasting for. This could be over, or it could start again in a few hours.
But if you add it all together, what were the Jewish violent attackers of Arabs within Israel, what were they protesting?
I remember the integration of Arabs within Israeli society, but these things were happening also in the Second Intifada. We don't remember it because we don't have social media. The Israeli media was much more focused on just the Arab side, what they were doing to us. So it's not totally new that there are reprisals and Jewish vigilantes. We've had that in the past. This is something that the media, you know, because they're everybody being everywhere with a camera and a smartphone, we're seeing more than we did. But I don't think this is totally unique and we didn't see these things before. I mean, I think if we look into Haaretz archives, we'll find small reports.
I think the Jews were, there were several reasons, but what they claimed that they were protesting against is the lack of governance and the fact that police did not intervene and protect some of the citizens in Lod, for example. That's how it started. They were protesting, that's what they're saying, the lack of governance, and they were protecting themselves. But of course, there's also the sense that there was an existential threat. People were talking, you know, our colleagues in different newspapers were talking about going back to 40, that this
not
is
only
the
our
second
colleagues,
48
the
war.
President, State President Reuven Rivlin also used terminology that belonged to the pre-state yeshuv of Paot.
Exactly. So they
disturbances.
Right.
Going back 100 years ago, as if
Paot
there's no
is
state.
Hebrew for pogroms.
Yeah. For pogroms. So he used the language of pogroms. That, you know, we haven't been covering the 1936 disturbances and then 1921.
We're not that old.
We're not that old. The newspaper is, but not us. But more seriously, immediately, voices of the establishment, not only the far right, use the language of pogroms as if there's no state, there's no police, there's no army, there's no structure, and we're going back to be a small yeshuv surrounded by hostile Arabs and an indifferent British mandate.
And each to his own, and everyone protects
and
himself.
And for one
yes.
moment, there's no political differences between Jews, because, you know, I spoke to people who were not very right-wing in Lod, who were saying to me, look, I hate the La Familia and Itzharnikim and all the other types of far-right vigilante groups who are around there. But when push came to shove, when we feared that there was a group of Arab rioters coming to burn our homes, our cars, and us, our families, they were the ones there when the police weren't there. So this has reduced people to their very basic identities as Jews and Arabs, for at least for a short while.
But why? Because of the nationalistic aspect.
And the fear, fear.
Talking about going back to, you know, the second 48 war means that there is still, the main issue is still national between Palestinians and Israelis, not just Jews and Arabs.
Mm. And in this, we have to remember that throughout the last year plus, during the coronavirus crisis, the idea was that, you know, that the Palestinian issue was over. The Abraham Accords that put it aside, the total indifference of the Trump administration to the Palestinians, the incoming Biden administration that, at least until violence broke out, also ignored the issue and has yet to decide whether the embassy in Jerusalem is also the embassy to, is the one state embassy created by Trump, which is also the embassy to the Palestinians, or they would rebuild another diplomatic representation American diplomatic representation to the Palestinians. These are very tough questions. They were pushed aside, and we all saw that the issue was solved, and all we have to do is whether one or two Arab parties will support the anti-Netanyahu coalition. And this changed overnight. We got back.
It didn't really change overnight. The Jews thought that it changed overnight, but Palestinians kept feeling these feelings, you know, all along, but just did not express them. Many of the young Palestinians wrote for Haaretz this week. They all said in different words, we were silent and we don't want to be anymore, well, because we didn't express those, you know, feelings that...
Even the older Palestinians of the joint list that was then the third largest party in the Knesset voted en bloc against the Abraham Accords.
But also, I think if you look back at this year of COVID, you could have seen these two different narratives fighting against them, because there was this narrative throughout COVID, look at all the medical teams, how 40% of the medical teams in the hospitals are Arab Israelis. I know I had one of my jabs from a Palestinian woman from East Jerusalem, and my second jab was from a Haredi medic. You know, this was kind of like a feeling, there was a feel-good feeling that we're all in it together, but at the same time, and this is something that we barely talked about here in Israel, but the international media noticed, when we were vaccinating, best in the world, fast, every blah, 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 we weren't vaccinating the Palestinians. And some people in the world noticed that, and certainly the Palestinians noticed that. And just think, go back 4 months. If the Israeli government said, well, obviously we're going to be vaccinating the Palestinians as well because we're living in the same area and just for health reasons we need to do it, how that could have changed their entire course of the last 4 months. If in December 2000, Netanyahu had said, well, we're going to be also supplying thousands of vaccines to the PA, because
I don't know if that would have solved everything.
Vaccination against rockets, shots against rockets.
You know, I don't know. It's a what if.
But you know,
it's a what if. But it could have changed the entire narrative.
We wrote several editorials to that calling.
No, we did.
Calling to vaccinate the PA. Not with thousands, but millions.
But we're only a small part of the Israeli media. So
no, I know.
But the media wasn't.
But some of the professionals in the healthcare establishment also argued for
all the professionals I spoke to, yes,
and mass vaccination of the Palestinians. But I think this appeared to be politically impossible.
Netanyahu could have sold it to the Israeli public if he wanted to.
The problem goes deeper than vaccinations, of course. But I think Professor Shlomo Zand wrote, I think, a brilliant op-ed in Haaretz. I don't know if it got translated to English in the end, but worth reading it. He mentioned something by Alexis de Tocqueville, that when there's more equality, then you notice how much lack of equality there is. And the story of Palestinians within Israel, and if you want, we can also claim that the prosperity in the West Bank maybe is part of it also. But the more that you actually have as if opportunities, the more there is as if coexistence and everything we just said about the staffs in the hospital and so on, so does the lie of equality. You can really see it much more. And I think from my conversations with people who were part of these protests from the Palestinian Arab side of things, this was their chance to say, look at this lie of coexistence that we're living in. That was part of the issue, and that's bigger than vaccinations.
And you wrote, Noah, that like feminist movements and black protest in the United States, the time has come for Arab women and men in Israel to force us to hear and see them shattering the glass ceiling, crushing their aspirations. How can they do that?
Well, you know, we had this blog post from a doctor who writes for us about his experiences in the ER. And he said, you know, I have this Arab colleague, female doctor colleague. We work together. We do everything together. But when the shift ends, she cannot rent an apartment in the Jewish town.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly
And
it.
I think this put it all together in like one paragraph.
That's the illusion of coexistence that they wanted to shatter, yes. Mm.
And how do they go about shattering this? I mean, with all due respect to Haaretz 21, the occasional op-ed on the pages of Haaretz isn't going to change anything. Can there be peaceful change at this critical historical junction in Jewish-Arab relations?
I'm not sure all of our listeners know what Haaretz 21
is. Well, please, please tell us.
It's an organizational effort to amplify stories and voices from our Palestinian communities within Israel by recruiting and training new writers in the newspaper. But yes, of course you're right. You know, one or two op-eds will not cause the change. We know the solution. The solution is that we need to have more encounters. We need to speak to each other. We need to really listen. Also, you know, Aluf just wrote an op-ed about the Nakba. It was before everything happened,
yeah,
right?
It was just on the verge. Yeah.
It's really interesting how, you know, you just wrote it just before it all started. But this is that op-ed, which I really also recommend reading, is part of the issue, because even the history is silenced and is not spoken about. So, of course, the first step, like in every resolution, needs to be listening, talking, you know, without censorship, and really, you know, putting things on the table.
Mm. First of all, don't underestimate the occasional importance of op-eds. You know, Zionism began as an op-ed, basically. Not as a journalist founded the Jewish state.
Good point.
But an op-ed is a conversation.
But also you're asking what can be done, Simon.
Yeah.
One of the problems, and we've spoken here on this podcast multiple times over the last year of COVID, is that what we don't have is a full concept of Israeli citizenship. We know what it is to be an Israeli Jew, but we spoke about this in a totally different context, in the context of the Haredi communities and their flouting of COVID regulations. And I remember Noah at the very, very beginning wrote a piece in Haaretz, which I've plagiarized since, about the autonomies. And she wrote about the Arabs and the Haredi. I've been since writing about the Haredi autonomy, but that is the real thing. There is about 30% of Israeli society which are not part of the citizenship feeling of Israel. It's 30 plus. And those are the Haredi communities and the Arab communities. And part of fixing this is not necessarily... obviously, we have to recognize the Nakba narrative and we have to work very hard on the Arab-Jewish relationships. But it's also about finding a real concept of Israeli citizenship, which doesn't exist, because it's all been sort of built, patch on patch, tlai tlai, as we say in Hebrew, since 1948, from emergency to emergency. And nobody's ever really... worked out. There's no Bill of Rights, there's no social charter. There are many things that exist, sort of like the unwritten constitution of the United Kingdom, but there isn't like a real articulation what it means to be Israeli. If and when that is articulated in a real way, then maybe there'll be a way of bringing in those two communities, which are very different places, but they're both sort of autonomous and separate from the Israeli mainstream. And we don't have that yet. And that is one thing op-eds are important for. We have to be articulating that. But also, just it's everything to do with legislation, how the economy is built, how the education system is run. Why isn't there in every city and town in Israel, where there is a sizable population, both Jewish and Arab, a school where they both go? It exists maybe in three or four towns in Israel. I can see some knowing glances.
No, we had this discussion.
We just discussed this, yes.
About should education integration be imposed? In order to...
First of all, it exists as an option. It's not even an option in most places. There are a few towns where they go to the same school, and that's it, but there's no...
Right, there are very few.
It's not even an option in most places in the country. So
at the risk of introducing a tone of optimism into the conversation, there was a rally last night in Tel Aviv attended by 3,000 people calling for a joint future between Jews and Arabs in Israel and Palestine. Is grassroots the way forward, or does this need to come from the top?
Everything is better to be from the top and from the bottom, you know, and it's a very long process, both institutional but also emotional, religious, and national obstacles. It's not an easy path to go, but then again, when you look back, it didn't happen 21 years ago. There was no rally like that.
Some would argue that the fact that things have died down is bad. There were many people who will say that the fact that there is no violence anymore, that the violence and the clashes and the rioting only lasted for a few days, is not a good thing, because now we can go back to the way things were before. And there are certainly people who wanted it, people who think that the old system has to be broken, who wanted the violence to continue at some level and saw the violence even as a positive thing. Now, I don't think anybody in this room thinks that, but
there is that view and it has to be taken into account. Mm.
There are things to be optimistic about. I mean, every time that you see that kind of violence emerge, there is a backlash. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who took part in the backlash this time. And also, yeah, I mean, I think a while ago in the past operations in Gaza, you had that, you know, small group of lefties demonstrating against the Minister of Defense. But you didn't have that new group called Standing Together, which mm-hmm. is Jews and Arabs protesting.
But there's also a backlash against the backlash. I'm thinking, for example, of CELCOM, which published a major telecommunications company, and Harel Insurance, both published full-page adverts calling for peace and coexistence and faced boycott threats. So
right, because it's a political fight. And of course, there is, you know, every side wants to answer. But a group like Standing Together, Omdim Beyachad, did not exist before. So this is something that I do, if someone wants to be optimistic, well, then that's an option, you know, to look at.
For several years now, the main issue dividing right and left in Israel ideologically is less the West Bank and the two-state solution and the Palestinian state, and more the deeper question of can Jews and Arabs live together at all, which the far right would say no. The medium right will try to ditch the question, and the left is saying yes. And it came to a head during the vote on the nation state law 3 years ago, which put it in words, and then Knesset was divided. From Lapid's party all the way to the left voted against it. All the parties from the right and the ultra-Orthodox voted for it. And under the law of unintended consequences, you saw more political integration of more Arab voters coming to vote. For the first time, serious conversations about Arab parties joining the coalition or supporting a coalition, which was unprecedented. So, you know, it's always a step forward, step backwards. Mm. But this is the main issue in Israel today. And, you know, the Supreme Court avoids the issue. For over 2 years now, it fails to decide on the legality of the nation state law. It's still, this hot potato is still way, way in the back burner. Mm. And any talk about government that would replace Netanyahu is based on the support of the Arab voters. And I think that even 10 years ago, people did not realize it in the same way they realize it today. So it's not back to normal. It's a struggle that's going on. But I think that the main issues to deal with are not just the political issue, but also the ability of this Arab physician to rent an apartment in Tel Aviv or in Haifa or wherever she was trying, or in Herzliya, wherever she was trying to find a place to live.
Guys, we're almost out of time. You mentioned the C word, coalition. I think we're going to have to end with a little bit of politics. Netanyahu may have been hoping that this last war would make it harder for the opposition parties, including Arab parties, to form a government to unseat him. Is it possible that this will backfire and there'll be a wave of pro-existence, anti-war sentiment sweeping Israel?
Wow, you're really optimistic now.
Well, we saw Naftali Bennett today criticizing Netanyahu for the way he handled the war and the entire situation.
From which side? From the
side of good governance. Mm. And he said that it's pulling us to a fifth election, which is disaster. And he didn't say a word, at least from the parts I've seen, he didn't say any criticism of the Arab parties, which means he leaves the door open, maybe not for a coalition, but at least for some anti-Netanyahu legislation in the Knesset.
I spoke to a couple of people very close to Bennett just before everything that happened in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I was trying to work out for a piece that I was planning to write, but so far we haven't, about how Bennett reached the conclusion that he has to split with Netanyahu, because we all know for many years there was this abusive relationship that Bennett couldn't extract himself from. And the thing that repeated itself is that Bennett saw during COVID something that kind of shattered his image of Bibi, that Bibi Netanyahu is a bad manager. And Bennett always thought that Netanyahu is some incredible operator, and that's why he was willing to forgive Netanyahu all the personal abuses toward him. And COVID shattered that. He saw that Bibi just is incapable of really running a civilian system. He could run the security, but more because they're better organized anyway. And all these hints are now also in this post that Aleph just mentioned, that Naftali Bennett put up today on Facebook. And what it's showing there is, I think, sort of the increasing shattering of Netanyahu's image on the right. And you see it in the way that Bennett and Gideon Saar, it is personal, but it's also some real criticism of how Netanyahu's managed the government. And I think you saw it also in the, where today's the 23rd, exactly 2 months since the election. Mm. We've already forgotten that.
Yeah.
What we saw in the election, the most important thing I saw, I think, was that Likud went down from 1.35 million to 1.05 million. So Likud lost 300,000 votes. They didn't go to other parties. They stayed at home. There is an increasing Bibi fatigue on the right. It's not, people are not moving to the center or the left. They're still staying right wing. But they're increasingly tired of Netanyahu. We're seeing it in the polls. We saw it in the election. We're seeing it in the way Bennett speaks about Netanyahu out in the open now. And I think that, yes, it has helped Netanyahu, the fact that he's managed to probably take off the table through this. I mean, like Alif said, he didn't actually make it happen, but this war managed, it was war helped him by taking off the joint Jewish-Arab coalition, which would have replaced him, maybe to come back, but right now it's not on the table. But this war, I think, will increase the fatigue. People, I think, are not looking at Netanyahu anymore as somebody who can really run the country and face all these challenges. I think the right wing are increasingly seeing him as tired, even if they don't have anything against him ideologically, even if they don't care about the corruption trials, they're seeing him as tired and not having the same kind of sharpness and magical abilities that they once ascribed to him. I think that's what we're seeing in Bennett now.
Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'll have to wrap it up there. Thank you, Aluf Ben, Noah Landau, Anshul Pfeffer. Thank you too to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. Join us again next week for another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv and happy birthday, Bob.